At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll. And I've got a quick favor to ask all of you sexy beasts before we get rolling in today's show with Living Color. I love doing this show for you twice a week. And the reason I'm able to do two episodes a week for free is thanks to all my great sponsors. And more importantly, to you for supporting the sponsors, okay? And this is where your help comes in. Podcast One and I want to make sure we have the best sponsors for Talk is Jericho. And we want to keep the commercials to a minimum as well. That's why it would be huge if you could fill out a short survey for me and this show at podcastone.com/my survey. It's only going to take a couple minutes of your time, and it's totally anonymous. It's going to help us get the right advertising in this show so we can keep it for free for you for twice a week. So please, please help out Talk is Jericho. Take the survey, even if you've taken it before. We really need you to take it again. Take it multiple times. It just helps me and helps this show. Once again, podcastone.com/my survey, or go to podcastone.com and click the survey banner. Thank you for doing that. Thanks for helping me out. And now, coming up on today's show, the entire band, Living Color, every member, the whole band is here. Corey Glover, the singer, Vernon Reed, guitar player, bass player, Doug Wimbish, and the drummer, Will Calhoun. First time ever, all four members of a band in the studio on Talk is Jericho. And we're talking about a lot more than just their latest mixtape EP, Who Shot Ya, and their upcoming tour of Australia and New Zealand, which starts in May. Follow them on Instagram at Living Color Official, or on Facebook at Living Color. And those with a U. That's the Canadian spelling, C-O-L-O-U-R. All the dates, all the tour dates, all the stuff is going to be up there. And I'll tell you this, they got some great stories about opening for the Rolling Stones, hanging out with Mick Jagger, how Mick Jagger really gave the band their start back in the day. Doug Wimbish was also almost in the Stones. And Vernon Reed was a part of Mick's solo band. He'll tell us about that. So many crazy stories. Conversation also takes a serious turn because this band is very much about social consciousness and equality. As you can imagine, they're talking about some serious issues affecting the world. Get ready, because you got some great rock and roll stories and a little bit of an education as well, something for all of us to think about. Living Color is going to be here.
This is Talk is Jericho.
All right, I mean, we're here at the Fillmore, and this is a monumental occasion because this is the biggest group of guys I've ever had on my show. The entire lineup of Living Color is here.
You haven't had this many black men in your presence in a long time,
Sit this close to me.
Here we go.
Hey, man, I'm from Canada, and this is true. So I grew up in Winnipeg, and there was more little people in my school than there was black people.
You mean like height challenge?
Midgets.
She's saying midgets.
My friend Hornswoggle's in the business. Midgets. There was more midgets.
That's what he's trying to say.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what. So to be this close.
So there were two midgets. Now, black person?
Yes. You got to figure out, this is Winnipeg, Canada. I'm sure you guys have played up there. Yeah. So it's a prairie. It's a tundra. Not a lot of black dudes there. There's a few, but we had two midgets and one black dude in the storm. Is this the most unique start to an interview you guys have ever done, right? But that's what I mean, man. So yeah, it's funny. This is a great collection. Every single guy from Living Color in the room.
Yeah.
So I have only four microphones.
Okay, I'm not talking into the microphone.
It's all right. I'm a professional. I'm just setting up a stand here while we're talking. I got a microphone in one hand. I'm screwing the stand in the other. I'm a true professional. It's like being in high school again. You got to set up your gear before, you have the jam. And I'm like the drummer. It always does the most shit that you got to set up, right?
First one there, last one to leave.
Yeah, exactly. But it's, I mean, this, we're talking about how you're on the road and have all the discussions that you have. And you guys have been on the road together for so many years, 20 years, 30 years. How do you, like, Corey, you said you don't stay sane when you're on the road.
You don't. Right? It's a weird life. You live in a coffin. You're like the undead.
Yeah.
You live on a bus. You live in this thing, in this cubicle. It's like a sarcophagus, and then you emerge out of that, and then
to feast on the living.
Exactly. Exactly. It's we're the Walking Dead, but you know. We get paid
actually
a little bit better.
Yeah.
It's a little bit better. A little bit better.
Mike, I actually like it.
Hey,
you like being on the road?
I like being on the road.
Yeah, on the
road. And he's crazy. See what I'm telling you?
I enjoy it. It's balance.
Also the drummer, though,
it's
right?
Balance. It's,
how do you mean?
Well, at home.
How do you mean?
Because we haven't seen it. We have not seen hide nor hair of this thing that you speak of.
Well, it's balance in that at home, it's a certain kind of way that you roll being a musician. You're playing locally, you're at home, you have your gear, and, you know, touring is a little bit more of an organized system. It's like a regiment.
Organized.
It's kind of a regiment. You have to be there a certain time. You're on a bus. You got deadlines. Things kind of move a certain way. When you're home, it's looser. You know, it's your own gear sometimes.
You're waiting for the tour manager to tell you what time to get out of bed.
Well, I don't know. I like it. I like touring because it's another option to going out and playing versus if I was only touring, I'd feel like Corey.
Who's nuts? Yes, that's what you're trying to say. Because Corey's crazy, right?
So it's a form of escapism. You know, we get to go out on the road and we kind of like, you know, you leave your issues at home.
Right.
But then they're stacked up waiting for you when you get back double time. You know what I mean?
Like a stack of bills.
There's a blessing and a curse that comes with this job, in a sense. You know, it's a responsibility. But then there's the families and loved ones that we leave at home. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we got to like almost kind of, it's like you're going out of the atmosphere, and then you just all of a sudden poof, you're like, I'm back home. I gotta walk the dog. Put the trash out.
Yeah, that's
take care of my kids.
When we were doing the Stones tour, we had a 2-week break. And I went home, and I was living at home with my parents at the time. And I walked in the door, I was like a big rock star. I felt like a rock star. My mother handed me a bucket and a bucket of paint and a brush and said, go paint the stoop.
Mr. Rockstar.
Right.
Mr. Touring with the Stones.
Exactly. And there's your balance.
There's
your balance.
That's exactly right. There's the balance we're talking about.
They missed the spot.
And I did. And my friends would drive by and like, look at you, you rockstar. You're an asshole. And they kept driving away. And I was like, I'm sitting there painting the stoop. Yeah. Red.
Red. This is red. And not to go into a history lesson here, but this is something I find very interesting, is that basically, Mick Jagger discovered Living Color. Is that true?
Well, actually,
and Doug was playing with Mick.
Well, the story goes like this. I was working with Mick at the time, and you know, I've known Vernon since 1980. We met at a session, and I was living in London, working with Jeff Beck over there. We were both in Mick's solo band. Living Color was starting to really crack the scene at the time, so I'm in the studio with Mick. And Mick hears, you know, Roger Trilling and some other friends that we, you know, that we were all, you know, kind of like associated with, kind of like we're getting in the mix here. He's like, yo, Dougie, I've been hearing about this band, Living Color. I said, well, just so happens, you know, I'd like to go check them out. I said, well, you know, they're playing the CBGBs. Just so happened y'all were playing down there that night.
CBGBs.
So Jeff Beck and Mick went down to go see him. And
Jeff Beck too. That's not intimidating.
It was a funny thing because our manager
told me the next day.
Our managers at the time said to me that Mick Jagger and Jeff Beck are in the audience, and I immediately put it out of my mind. Mm-hmm. Like my immediate thing to do was to say they're not here. That's bullshit. Because if I let it enter my mind that they were there, it would have started me down a spiral that would have just affected me. So when we hit, I literally denied it because I know how my mind is.
Right, sure.
Like spiral.
You'll psych yourself out.
No, we all get it.
Spiral, you know, out of control with anxiety.
Yes. You know, I know.
My anxieties are many.
Yes.
Well, you know what happened after that? I mean, they did the gig, right?
Yeah.
And then the next day, we're at Right Track Recording Studios. We're in the process of mixing his record. Mm-hmm. So he comes to me and he goes,
Dougie, I really like the band. You know, what should I do with him? I'm like, you're Mick Jagger, man. You busted all these blues kids. Excuse my French. Can I cuss on this?
Absolutely.
Okay. I said, you know, you're Mick Jagger, man. You know, you busted a lot of, you work a lot of blues cats, and you know, you've nicked a lot of blues stuff as well. So take him in the studio and do something with him. Yep. And it just so happened I was, Ed Stasium was the engineer at the time.
Yep.
And on the weekends, the actual studio was free.
Right.
So Mick was to Ed Stasium, was like, Ed, would you mind coming in and doing, I want to bring Living Color in here and do a demo with the band on the weekend. Ed said, sure. Hmm. And that's how the whole process started.
And Ed, you know, we hit it off immediately. And, you know, there's a kind of funny, because at any point it can go sideways. Like at one point, we had folks from Elektra Records were interested in us, and it went really high up, and the president of Elektra Records said, nope, I don't like the band.
Because I sounded like Ben Vereen.
I'll chime in on that. You know what?
He said you sound like Ben Vereen.
Here's what happened. I'll never forget, because...
Sorry, Doug.
Because he didn't like it. It sounded like Ben Vereen.
He didn't like the singer. He said, the singer sounds like Ben Vereen.
but
I sound like a Broadway singer. It's like,
you know, Mick was trying to shop the record around at first. At that time, he was signed to Walter Yetnikoff.
Oh, yes.
Over at CBS, Epic, right? Yeah. And he was quite frustrated because it took him a while to get Living Color, you know, kind of like placed and signed. He was pissed off. And I'll never forget the day we were in the studio. He came to me and said, he was all happy. He said, yo, Dougie, I got the band signed. He got them signed. He got you guys signed to Epic. But it even took Mick Jagger a moment to make that happen. Because, you know, it took a minute. It didn't happen overnight.
It did not happen.
So Vernon and I were at several meetings, like little indie record labels, all this stuff. Like, yeah, it'd be great. But it's like, yeah, it'd be great. But the four of us at the time went to a record company where a guy jumped up on his desk and told us, what do I got to do to sign you guys? And then turns out he couldn't do it either. I mean, he literally jumped up on his
desk. That was Capital. Corey and I went in there. He did a soft shoe and did the whole, I want to sign you guys.
Why is that? Because you're talking about the late 80s. Was it because you were a guitar-driven, was it a black rock and roll band thing?
No, it was black. It was basically, it was just straight up, you know, fear of a black planet.
That's what I'm wondering, right? How do we mark, what do we do with
Where do we put it in the bins at Tower Records?
At that time, like too, man, I mean, black music had a certain kind of a, it was kind of weird for us even to go to the record labels because they had black music departments. And we would
really?
Oh yeah. The record labels,
they would
we were when you go into Sony or a major label, there were black music departments, there was stuff for punk, there was stuff for jazz.
Every
it was separated.
Genre.
It was you know, you got off the elevator. So when I went over to the black music department on a how you guys doing, and I got looked at like I had on a Klan's uniform. So you know, it's like I grew up in the hood. I like music, you know. A lot of people don't understand the reality of Living Color's existence. Put the hit songs aside and Mick Jagger and all of that. Where we come from and who we are and how people couldn't get comfortable around us because most of the time their own issues. So I love R&B. Everybody over there had a suit on. Everybody was kind of fronting on this kind of a, you know, church, almost slick R&B black vibe, but they also listen to Sly Stone. They also listen to Jimi Hendrix. They also listen to, what do they identify with? And in that office, they had to identify with this sheen, shine, Jerry Curl, almost S kind of R&B kind of a thing.
Right.
And then we came along and we were on the other side of the label with all the big money-making white artists. So when I went over to say hello, I almost felt like I was being, it was like, well, what are you doing here? Well, it's all music, isn't it? So it's an interesting take on the first comment Corey made about not being signed versus when I don't know about you guys, when I first walked into a record label, I didn't know it was segregated like that. I wasn't hip to that. Maybe you guys went to, that was my first experience going into a label and realizing, oh, well, like I figured it's Columbia. I'm a jazz fan. I'm like, man, I want to get some Miles Davis. Oh, you got to go upstairs to the 15th floor. And you go upstairs and you get out the elevator and they're like, this guy from Living Color's here. What the hell does he want? I mean, it's that
guy. Right.
You know,
not even 30 years ago. It's such a short period.
The record labels, they kept you on another side of the hallway on a different floor. So when we were up at Sony, we were with rock artists. Mm-hmm. Whoever was on the rock sign and was in those offices, it's a great hang. If I wanted to go pick up the new Miles Davis release, I had to go to a different floor. They had to call and give me permission. When I went to the black music department, I had to go over there, and it was like I was entering a new country.
We were an enigma anywhere we went. And like Will was saying, despite the hit record or our association with Mick Jagger, people looked at us very strangely, and they tried to figure out who and what we were. Mm-hmm. Like, I go to a hardcore show, and people are like, why are you here? I'd go to a hip-hop show, and they'd go, why are you here?
Because you're too much of a rock guy.
Yeah, it's like I was too much
you
of an.
You couldn't fit in anything.
I didn't fit. We didn't fit into any particular place. We have funny stories. Like people didn't want to approach us because they thought we were particular. We were a particular kind of people. Some people didn't want to deal with us because they thought we were too militant. Some people didn't want to deal with us. They thought that we were trying to do was be white. I had a friend
that was
of mine.
A very painful thing. That
happened on the Oprah Winfrey show.
That was by very painful.
Yeah,
that
it happened
was,
on the Oprah Winfrey
what
show.
What happened on Oprah?
On Oprah, they had a show about. Painful. I'm going to call it out. About blacks that want to be white. Now we had nothing to do with the show. They had very light skinned people who were saying, "My grandmother's this. I had blue eyes. I had green eyes. Why do you straighten your hair?" It was a horrifying show. But in the commercial break, you know how they fade, they'll say a topic, and now we're going to come back to, you know, blacks who are really black and want to be that. They played the cult video.
Wow.
And, right. And somebody at Sony had to call Oprah's, whatever it's called, her production
producers, Harpo,
to say, what the hell's going on? You owe us an apology, because they didn't ask for that. So there it is, a show about blacks wanting to be white, and in a commercial, to fade to commercial, Corey's in the mic shaking his hair around.
Right,
and
suddenly
we got nothing,
saying.
And we got nothing to do with that.
How'd you feel
topic.
About that, Vernon?
That was incredible. For me, that was incredibly painful. Because the thing about us is that we never accepted the idea that rock is not black music. Rock is everyone's music. One of the things for me is rock represented, the rock artists I appreciated, they were doing their own thing. Jimi Hendrix's, the Sly Stones, the Led Zeppelins, the Police, U2, Peter Gabriel. To me, rock represented being able to say what you want to say. So you could be whoever you want to be. And then you get in it, and then there's all these rules to follow.
The problem with the thing I want to connect to what Vernon and Corey are saying is, Living Color in a lot of ways, and I don't mean to say this in any kind of academic way, wasn't supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. The problem with Living Color's success was it became all of those things Vernon said we're supposed to be, we were not. We weren't put into a category. So you're right. You go into a label, you go somewhere. How are you going to, if you're hip hop, how you know, gold chains and what? But what is Living Color to other people? We had no problem being Living Color. But when we showed up, and it happened at Rock Awards, the Grammys, getting in the elevator with cats, that we were like this, oh shit. Now, if I say this, I'm not sure about that. Or some people just vibe, just like Corey said. But that's their issues. They have it with themselves.
But let me tell you, but from a rock kid point of view, being 16 or 17 and being a total metal guy, right. When Living Color came on the scene in Winnipeg. Once again,
right.
There's no black or white there. It's just people are people. That's just the way it is when you grow up in that place. And to see Living Color, I think I heard the tune first, Cult of Personality. This is great. Yeah. The guitar is great. The vocals are great. And then you see, God, they're black? This is really cool because I've never seen that before. And also what you guys did was start teaching metal kids about the funk and about the groove. Some bands had it, but you guys really locked in on it, especially like I remember on our radio station, Open Letter was a big hit. Mm-hmm. And that is super funky and groovy. Okay. So when you got guys who are obsessed with Metallica and Anthrax, who also had, you know, Public Enemy and I'm the Man, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about Iron Maiden and Judas Priest and Ozzy, and then you guys come on, it still fits that genre, but it's completely different, but it's still heavy and it fits.
It's like, you know what, Anthrax did bring the noise. I mean, that was such a fantastic moment. Or when Run DMC covered Walk This Way.
Right.
And we got a chance to play Walk This Way last summer when we toured with them.
So you toured with Run DMC?
No, with Anthrax.
Oh, Aerosmith.
So it's like a kind of closing of all kinds of circles.
Sure.
The DJs just want to hear the beat.
Yeah.
They're not concerned with who's on the record cover.
I don't think the kids really did either. Maybe it was the suits, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing about culture that's deep. Growing up in the Bronx, especially in the whole hip-hop vibe about scratching, DJs wanted to find loops. So there were a lot of black kids that grew up not even knowing the history of Aerosmith, or who Aerosmith maybe even was, that heard that groove and it got locked. And you know, some did, but I'm just saying it. That's the thing interesting about culture. People attach themselves to something that they like without getting into white, black, north, south, east, west.
Yeah.
It's something that is a connection. I asked, when we were on tour with them, you know, I asked the guys about the video.
Aerosmith?
I spoke to directly about, and I was talking to Joe, and they said basically they were on a flight and they got a phone call about doing a video. And the minute, Steven told me, the minute he got off the plane, the band got the plane, the guy who was going to direct the video wanted to meet them to run the concept down because nobody wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
At the label, they didn't want to. And Steven said, when he told me, you're going to sing the line, they're going to scratch, and I get to knock the wall out. You know what I mean? And
the mic stand.
And we're going to get together. He was like, let's do the video.
That was a major metaphor in that. Yeah,
that's the thing that he talked about. The metaphor of, he said, oh, I get to smash, take the microphone.
Breaking the wall down.
And break the wall down. You know, the Run DMC's on the other side. I want to do this video.
You know, that's the connection. If you think about it, if you go back, you look at Living Color and its history, and you look at like a DJ like Grandmaster Flash or Kool Herc or some of those DJs that were bridging sonics. They just knew that if it's grooving and you can get somebody on the dance floor and vibe it out, it's cool. So there's a deep connection between a band like Living Color, who has, it's kind of like, we like all kinds of music, and a hip hop DJ who liked all kinds of music and was able to bridge that stuff together and start to introduce that to the block parties.
Mm-hmm. I still think that at the end of the day, people dig what they dig, but if you can control the environment, it does make a difference. And that controlled environment had an effect on us.
Mm-hmm.
It had an effect on our success and our outcome, I think, and how people viewed it. I think Living Color is responsible for, you know, smashing a hole in that wall as well, too. You know, absolutely.
Talk is Jericho.
How were you guys accepted when you first came on the scene with Vivid by the rock community?
I didn't feel anything about rock communities on bands that we were already out there, because we kind of already had relationships with some of the bands by going out and playing on them. There were some vibes, I'm not afraid to say, from some more known musicians. I felt visually there was running a little bit with one or two of the Led Zeppelin dudes. I'm just going to speak freely about it. I don't give a shit about that. Sting.
Sting in a bad way.
Yeah, well,
it was a little uncomfortable. You could feel some vibes.
It wasn't like a there were some people. Yeah, Eric Clapton was the darkest, but I mean, there were other musicians that came out and were like, "Hey, what's going
like
on?"
Jack Bruce was in the
other people came out and were like, it was really openly greeting, you know, Little Richard and other people that were just really like, hey, white, black, whatever. But there were some people who
gave you
they weren't really sure. So it was like a little bit, you know, it was like, well, these guys are kind of clever. And also, honestly, Mike, when you go to an event, it's almost like the music pigeonholing gets carried over into the visual, artistic introduction pigeonholing. So we don't look like other black people that are at those events. I have to say, honestly, or they expect you to be a certain kind of a way. And our music threw people off. And then the vibe, we just showed up, you know, you articulate.
But the chorus got long, saying, green, and blue, and red hair.
Forget about the body glove.
Yeah, yeah.
Forget about the hair and the body glove for a minute.
Right.
I'm talking about going to an event and saying hello to somebody and saying what's up. There is that underground racism of you maybe having to be a clown or maybe having to have on 80s. Going to early 90s.
Right, right.
Certain kind of a jewelry, untied sneakers.
Big hair, you know,
and you're going like, hey, how's it doing? And you're talking about intelligent things. People who have their own issues have a hard time pigeonholing you into, you can't get pigeonholed now. So, well, I thought they were like this, but hang on a minute. And a lot of those times they came out with very positive relationships afterwards.
Right.
You know, but yes, we walked into those with people wanting us to be, you know, this cup. And if you're not that cup, I don't know really how to talk to you, because all the black people I know are like that cup.
Right.
And now that you're not like that, they. But I have to say, like I would say 70% of the time, it flipped and people were like, once, oh, okay.
And it
was positive.
We had a lot of kinship with a lot of bands. Bands like Soul Asylum, we kind of came up together.
Same vibe, yeah.
You know what I mean? Of course, the bands we looked up to, like Bad Brains. I've already mentioned Anthrax, you know, a Fishbone, Soundgarden, you know, there were
R.E.M.
Right, there were other artists that were really kind of like, yo, we're in this thing.
Mm-hmm. And it was very cool.
You know? one of the things I really want to mention is the support we got from one particular club owner, but really a whole scene. It was Hilly Crystal and CBGB's. We would have never happened.
Which is a famous, almost a punk rock club in New York City.
Yeah, well, the thing is, we're also talking about an era that's really past.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we came up in an era where there were a lot of places to play, and for whatever kind of scene you wanted to be into. And Hilly Crystal, the owner of CBGB's, he took a liking to the band. And part of the thing about Hilly's history is that Hilly was the manager of the Vanguard, the jazz club on West
Village. Yeah, famous place, right?
So when he heard us doing, because I came out of a kind of crazy free jazz almost background mixed with rock music. So we would do these things. He would hear it. He didn't hear it like, I don't know what you boys are trying to do. He understood exactly what it was. So Hilly really already had insight. And then there were people like Steve Gallagher who booked us. You know what I mean? Like, oh, there were folks.
Steve Martin.
You know, Steve, you know, there were folks, and there were all these places to play. There was the Lone Star Cafe when it had Iguana on the roof on 13th Street. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, these are the things. Tramps, the Cat Club, Danceteria.
The Ritz.
The Ritz.
For the metal guys, L'Amour.
Academy.
L'Amour. Yeah.
You know, all of these spots. And once we started to develop, it took a lot of changes. But once we started to develop a local following, that's really when it changed for us. It went from being like this weird, I don't know what that guy's trying to do, and then suddenly it became a thing. But all along the way, there have been people that just said stuff. You know, knowing Doug back in the days, there was a photographer named Steve Critchlow. You know, he was young and he passed away back then. And I remember when I would do these shows with then a trio. It was mainly instrumentals. I came from an instrumental thing. And I wrote this song, Funny Vibe, because this lady had clutched a handbag when I got in an elevator and it pissed me off and it made me,
you know. Wow, yeah.
So I started playing the song. And Steve said to me, he ran into me on the street. He said, Vernon, you have to decide what you want to do. Like, you're doing these instrumentals, you're doing this other thing, you can't do both. And so one day I decided I'm going to leave the vocal, because I wrote a couple other songs, I was messing with it, and I did a show, and I was like, I'm just going to do the instrumental thing. So I decided the other thing. And this poet friend of mine, Jessica Hagedorn, a great novelist and writer, she came up to me after this. She said, why'd you take out the songs with the words? So I was waiting to hear these tunes. And that's when it flipped.
Hmm.
And then got a call to open for Fishbone's first show. I had already opened for the Art Ensemble of Chicago in the same room. So then I realized, I can't be the singer. I'm too nervous. I'm too shaky.
Mm-hmm.
And I met this guy at a birthday party that my sister dragged me to. And I gave him a call. And all of these things, like one thing led to another thing. We were left in a lurch.
This was Corey, the guy at the birthday party?
And you know, we did a
gig. You regretting it ever since?
Yes.
And so there's like a whole history. And we had a different band.
He didn't get a cake.
And they were snapped up by an English rock star who shall remain nameless.
Well, the whole band.
Our bass player and drummer at the time snatched up, and we had a gig to do. We had like a few days, and I remember I was introduced to a drummer. I met a drummer, Jaco Pistorius, introduced me to a drummer.
Wow.
At a gig where I used to play 55 grand. I called him up, and it was nutty. I'm canceling the gig.
No, you don't understand. I was getting calls every 15 minutes, vacillating between the two extremes. Just, we're not doing a gig. I got somebody. And he can't do it. I got somebody else. It's like for an hour and a half, I get getting calls from Vernon saying, we're doing a gig. We're not doing a gig. We're doing a gig. We're not doing a gig. We're doing a gig. We're not doing a gig. Stop calling me.
I'm going to fake it through mine.
What happened was this. It came to my mind that if we don't do this gig, the band is over.
But if we do the gig and it sucks,
band is over.
Still over.
You know, and it was not the most pristine and exact. Yeah. But you know, we survived.
Yeah.
And we got, and it's the thing is, and it's really about a lot of it is, you know how it is, man. You get knocked down, it's what you do next.
Mm-hmm. Sure. How do you respond?
You know, it's like if you're down on the mat, what happens next determines the whole thing. You can stay down. You can listen to what those people tell you. Because all of us that became musicians, unless you came from a musical family where that's the family business.
Right.
Unless it's the family business, your parents are very concerned about your future. They're not happy.
Yeah.
They're not happy. And they want to dissuade you from this foolishness.
My father was very concerned whenever Vernon came to my door.
That guy is back.
Well, Vernon, you know, the thing about when Vernon was calling me was, I wasn't confused by what he was saying. He was just calm. And I didn't feel like he was interested in doing it because he was like, man, I don't know if I'm going to do this gig. I'm not sure if I'm going
to. Probably going to suck anyways.
Like he was, all right, cool, man. I'll talk to you later. And he called me back. I think we should do the gig. I'm not really sure. And I'm saying to myself, man, for a guy who sounds, it's a subject matter right. sounds crucial, he sounds like he doesn't give a damn about right. the gig. So yeah. I just kept saying, all right, man, whatever you want to do. Then he was like, you'd have to learn all the songs today. It's 10 songs. And I think you could learn the songs today. Yeah, man, I'll learn the songs. That's a lot of songs. You know, it was like you kind of back and forth, back and forth. But it was Maxwell's, and I was happy to do it. And during one or two of my college drives down to New York, and I met Vernon and then the BRC, and then he played my college band on his radio. He had a radio show with Greg Tate, and he played my music on his radio show, and we just were kind of talking along that line. But when I want to bring something up, when you talk about, Doug talked about the whole thing and history and Jagger and the black bands and everything, it was really interesting because if you look at Jagger and Bowie and maybe some of the artists Vernon may not want to mention.
Can I?
Well, you know, you know.
What does it rhyme with?
It's no. It's
Beef Bintwood.
No. When you look at these kind of bands, a lot of I'm just gonna say this because of my generation.
Right.
I grew up admiring, you know, a lot of the Carlos Alomars and the Ronnie Draytons, and because you know, and Steve Jordan lived around the corner from me. These are guys that I saw as a you know 13, 14 year old that were doing the thing I wanted. They were there. They were neighborhood guys that were, you know, Eddie Martinez. They were guys that were there. Mm-hmm. So it just immediately gave me the gumption that it's possible and I can do it. It's not a problem. But it's very interesting how growing up, I have an older brother who's 6 years older than me. So that generation is that band, the real band generation. Four horns, two keyboard players, two guitar, you know. That
was everyone sings.
Everybody sings, you know, 13 cats on stage. Mm-hmm. So I got to watch that. The interesting thing that happened, though, was, which makes Vernon's story about starting Living Color interesting, is most of our communities got cleaned out by these English rock stars.
They come pick up all the best players.
Yes, right. the and some American ones, mm-hmm.
but, like Beef.
But they came through.
Beef is from England, isn't it?
Yeah. They came through. So a lot of the bands that I saw when I was 13 that were killer never happened because those guys went off the
cherry picked.
So when he did, Doug was a master of that. But when he decided to do, I'm sure he's working Beef. I'm sure Vernon got the same calls.
Oh, did you?
No, it's Buy or Buff.
Buy or Buff, yeah.
It's so fascinating that you bring that up because it brings to mind some things that I remember happening, like the kid bands. I was in a band briefly with Omar King.
And who went to Sting's band.
Right, but there was like...
He just played Journey last year.
There were a bunch of artists, musicians, like Busta Jones, R.I.P., you know what I mean? They were in the mix big time, but they were kind of like hired hands. Mm-hmm. We were influenced by just a lot of tremendous people. And when somebody says, you know, I started playing the bass, or I started playing the drums, or I started playing guitar, I'm not talking about grown ass people, mm-hmm. and which is kind of disturbing. I was 4 years old. What? You know, I'm on my second marriage. You know? Oh my God. And they say, it's just like meeting the artists that right.
Sure.
For us. Yeah.
Right.
We're part of, you know.
You've become now, the longevity you have has now made you guys influences, you know, for all the different musicians and different bands and stuff.
Like it's like to be with, to be here, you know.
With Jane's Addiction.
With Jane's Addiction is so awesome because, you know, we played the first Lollapalooza and it's just, it's, we hadn't seen them for a long time, but it's great to be in, because this is kind of where we have a simpatico, you know what I mean?
Because Jane's also another band that broke down a lot of walls with their style of music. Mm-hmm. Completely original and strange at the time, you know? But another thing I want to talk about your new single, Who Shot Ya, is Living Color's always had an interesting message in the songs, even going back to, I had no idea what a cult of personality was when I first heard it. Open Letter, Desperate People, Elvis is Dead, Type, all these different amazing stories. And now with this single, in the world that we live in today, why did you pick that song? And it's the perfect song to describe some of the relations going on, race relations with the cops and kind of the society that we live in now.
Well, the thing about it wasn't meant to be, and I'm going to let Corey fill it out, but it really happened organically because we would do sound checks and Corey would do the verse from Who Shot You. Mm. And when we were getting ready to do this record, we had already recorded a song by Robert Johnson, The Preaching Blues. And I was like, you know what? We should record Who Shot You, because you're, every time we do a sound check. So it wasn't picked. It wasn't picked to comment on, it's terribly, not ironic, it's terribly coincidental.
Sure.
But, you know, it really came out of this organic thing of, oh, this is something that he loves. You can't lose with something you love.
Yeah, the song in and of itself was always, it's like, I always thought that we should do something with this song. Like, I always thought I had a tongue-in-cheek sort of idea about this song where it's sort of like spoken word and you know, and you're snapping your fingers. What really became profound about doing this song, I'm going to shoot you myself. Me.
I did it.
No, but I thought that the song was very prescient in what was going on. Which was a continuum of what's going on in terms of the culture, the gun culture, that not just, you know, in African American communities or in people, communities of color, but around North America,
everywhere
in North America, the idea of guns. It's funny. There was a discussion on the bus last night. A couple people in our crew are dyed-in-the-wool liberals, just the fuzziest liberals you ever want to meet in your life. And some other guys kind of lean to a more conservative kind of thing, and the subject of guns came up. And there was, on one side, it's about this particular weapon, it's about this, that, the other, and the other guy was like, you have no idea what you're talking about. You don't know what guns are. You have no idea what guns are. It's such a convoluted, huge mess of a thing to understand, but that the bottom line is that it destroys people. And there was somebody was saying something like, the only people who have problems with guns are people without guns.
But that's the thing. It's such a hot button topic. It's almost like religion, politics, and gun control.
Exactly. So
you don't throw those in.
You don't talk about that in polite society. So, but we do. and we broached a lot of subjects on several different occasions. But the idea of guns and how they've proliferated our ideas of how the world works, like from the tiniest thing, like if you are in a fight, it ends when the guns come out. To, you know, is a global sort of problem. We must bring out the bigger guns. Mm-hmm. These are it's a part of all that we do. And why not talk about it? And why not? I don't have a solution for it. I don't know whether banning guns or giving everybody a gun or taking away everybody's guns, any of that's going to make any difference. They're just going to invent a different gun. So, you know, take away all the guns. Okay, so we can make a gun out of a light bulb.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Give everybody a gun. Everybody's dead. So there's no real solution to it, but to shine a spotlight on the situation is something that is necessary.
Well, the problem is also the pace of change, because, you know, like Jackie Robinson had to bite the bullet. He had to go through all of that, you know, because we had to force, the change had to be forced. The Edmund Pettus Bridge had to happen. Mm-hmm. John Lewis had to do that. Like, there's a whole thing of, we're gonna change, don't make it happen too soon. And it got to the point where the situation is intolerable. The situation is intolerable. And the thing that's so interesting is, like, people are comparing unjustified, unwarranted police shootings to lynchings. But what people misunderstand, because I misunderstood it. See, I thought lynchings were some kind of spontaneous explosion of rage. Lynchings were social events. Lynchings were social events. Tickets were sold.
You're kidding me.
I learned this. They sold parts of bodies.
They sold pieces of people's liver, souvenirs. Fingers. That's the part that they don't talk about.
See, the thing is, I learned this working on a film called Through a Lens Darkly, and it's about black people as subjects of photography and as photographers. And one of the things that they had in the movie was a ticket, was postcards. Postcards were made and sold of lynchings, and tickets to lynchings.
Wow.
Like, the idea of, we're going to take an extra legal step, and not only that, we're going to sell concessions to it. So the absolute depravity and horror of it is kind of minimized. I mean, the image of the person hanging or being burnt is horrific enough. But when you think about it, it was a business. To consider that meant that if you didn't attack it, where was it going to go next?
Sure, right.
And this is part of the issue and the problem, because justice was never dealt with at the time. People were above the law, and they turn around and say, okay, what about black on black crime and this, that, and the third? Well, there's issues of, there are all kind of issues involved with it, but because we're not able to form a language of just like, you know what, I'm not gonna throw your feet in the fire. You weren't there, I get it,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm not blaming you, but can we talk about the fact that this actually happened in our country and move on from that?
It's right. Education in a sense, you know what I mean? It's like anything else, like you have,
you have a lot of situations where things just happen and doesn't get discussed. You know, and it's how you're raised. Look, when you're a kid, you're 2-3 years old, you don't see black or white. You see a kid, it's a kid.
Right.
Right.
You're taught by, when you're watching your elders and you see how they respond around stuff, and then you pick that up.
Mm-hmm.
You get into, it's how you're educated. If you're educated, if you raise a dog, right, and you're trying to get the dog goes in the garbage can, and you want to train this dog not go in the garbage can, you know what I mean? Then one way to do it is put some Scotch bonnet in the garbage can and you let him taste that. He ain't gonna go in there again.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? It's like certain things you can do to kind of like spark a reality of like, that's not right for me to do. Dog pisses on the floor. You can't just take his nose and rub it into it. He don't know any difference. You got to take him outside and let him know that that's what's going on. So it's like, in a sense, it's like education. You have to teach people at an early age, this is wrong.
Right. Sure.
Chris.
Right.
That's part of the cult of personality. That's part of that idea that I can show you a better way. That this is the way. I know the way. There's the people who are doing that right as we speak. That's the history of politics, is that I know a better way. Follow me.
Mm-hmm.
I see the world as it is. Come this way, and your friend over there feels the same way, and so does his friend and everybody else. So let's do this. Make me president. Make me.
That's the cult of personality.
That's the cult of personality. Right. We all know that those people do those things, and they do those things for those reasons. Come on.
Well, that's what happens when we're kids. It's to say, let's shift the music, for example. Like, when you get to a certain point, you start digging certain music, right? Then you got some folks that are like, you know, there's a lot of musical police officers out here that will arrest your ass. Now, I'm playing rock and roll, but you're not supposed to listen to jazz.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Especially when you're a kid, yeah.
When you're a kid,
you're a teenager.
You play metal. Yeah. Why are you playing funk?
Yeah, you can't like them both.
Cool. You playing jazz, and some cats are like, that ain't the shit. And other cats, jazz cats are like, well, you couldn't swing if you were hanging from a float. So it's kind of like, you know, it's all in the mentality right. of what goes on up here.
Yeah.
It's all what lies between your two ears in this cranium right here. And you get programmed over time by the people that influence you, starting with your family. If you got a racist ass mother and father, there's a good chance your ass is going to be racist too. And all depends, or it could flip, but it all depends on how you are processing that information. And if you stay in one sector of a certain thing, how are you possibly going to get out of it? So it's like this, I come from a city, Hartford, Connecticut. Hartford is a nice, you think it's a nice, clean-cut city, right? You know, insurance cap. It's got one of the highest murder rates in America for the side. And people are so ingrained in the ghetto there, you know what I mean? It's almost like hopeless for you to get out. There's many blocks you can go, but because of the environment that you were taught and you were trained, you only stay within those certain blocks. That's what you know. That's kind of what you became familiar with. And anything else is like watching a movie. You don't want to go there because you're trained to stay within
it's
these
real talk.
Particular vibes.
Think about how things are designed. Like housing projects. One of the things that always struck me is that you have to pay for things to be pretty. Mm-hmm. Like, so why do people who are poor have to live in ugly circumstances? That's because that's the municipal will. That's kind of like...
But doesn't it cost money to have those things?
Actually, something to look good, actually...
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And it's all about the character of it. I'm on the Bronx Council of the Arts, and there's a very wealthy woman who took her money to start this council to go into Freeman Street and Simpson Street. You guys know that neighborhood. At that time, it was some of the worst neighborhoods in the Bronx, and put up buildings where... They're regular, nice-looking buildings. The apartments are different. They look like Manhattan Plaza inside. They're gorgeous. If you want to, she has a woman on the top floor. Everybody gets a cutout about twice the size of the square. If you want to learn how to grow corn and beans and peas, there's a lady who works with her, top floor. Everyone in the building gets to have their own little section to grow their own food.
Right.
So you don't got to go to the grocery store if they're selling crap food. She just went to this concept of it. She has another building of... Single and married couples who have children with challenges, whether they're mentally, you know, they're banging on the walls, or they're loud, or they're, you know, they have padded rooms like recording studio apartments. She has another building of people who get out of prison and they can't get jobs and can't get apartments because of their record. So this is just a little small area with these three different style buildings where it looks nice. It's not so fly like it is on Fifth Avenue, but people, she told us it didn't cost a lot of money to do it. It took a few people who wanted to see it happen.
Right.
One of the things that have been, fortunately, being in this band, some of the accoutrements of being in this band is I've been able to travel. I will say more recently, my favorite spot has been Mali. It's been West Africa. And I've been researching music and studying and driving around to the northern part of the country. And one of the things that, I mean, I got lost a million times. I had, you know, it was so hot. Sometimes we had exploding tires, all kinds of madness. But it was great. I met great people, great musicians. One of the things that was the most profound for me, like starting to do that, like the first time, was all of the master musicians that I wanted to meet. I was trying to study this music and learn about. They were all these tucked away families. They were tucked away. They were out in it. And I went to see these people that had dirt floors, spotless clean homes. I never heard any parent or any elder yell at anyone younger than them. There was never a chastising thing. There was never a get over here. The 13-year-olds look after the 10-year-olds, look after the 5-year-olds, look after the infants. There was order in these villages where there's no police, there's no jails, there's nobody walking around with any weapons being exposed, no violent language, no even loud speaking. And when I first started going into these places, I was like, wow, you know, they're controlling their environment on wealth and value. Not, you know, the most valuable thing in those communities are the elders. The oldest people are the gods. That's what you want to be like. That's who you go to talk to. One part of Mali, I got to tell you, that was deep. I have a photograph of it. They have this stone circle, and you have to crawl into it, and you can't stand up in it. You have to sit in it. And it's stone. It's just cracks from the rocks. It's made totally with stones, no cement. And it's cool in there because it's hot as hell outside, and the air blows in there. And I was like, man, what is this thing for? Oh, this is where we meet historically, thousands of years ago, still there to when there's a problem in the village. Mm-hmm. And you know why we all come in here? You can't stand up. You can't jump up and go, hey, man, you'll hit your head. The environment is set for you to calm down, chill.
Interesting.
We're going to talk about this. No one's going to yell. No one's going to cut anyone off. No one's going to stand up. No one's going to point. So there's stones, and you sit down. The ceiling's about right here, and there's stones, like the smallest ones the size. You stand up, you're going to get knocked out.
Right.
And I went in there, and the elders wanted to show me, because I was fascinated by, wow, this is... I said, well, let me show you what my grandfather showed me and his grand. And this is a place where you go, and you sit down, and is this a problem? Corey's spot, village, is vibing with Doug's, vibing with mine. Vernon doesn't have a vibe, so we're going to go to Vernon's village where there's no vibe, because everybody's village has a stone thing. And we're going to all sit down in there, and we're going to have this conversation. So we leave there clear. No one's going to be like, that doesn't exist. He wanted me to see what the importance of how, because I was blown away. I was like, man, cats are... You gotta walk 5 miles for water. That would piss
sense,
me.
Right?
That would piss me off just to go on to get the water. You know what I'm saying? But it was amazing. Interesting because when you talk about value, like I really gotta know another whole look.
But it's just that. Like going to Japan where they treat the elders as elders.
Yeah.
They're not senior citizens. They're people that you go to for advice. A lot of Japanese kids are more closer to their grandparents than their parents because the grandparents will give them. Here, it's not like that as much. I find that that senior citizens kind of get kind of swept away a little bit more. When you go to that culture, the seniors are still at the top of the food chain, as they are, I think.
The information is there and the experience
right,
is there.
To help.
And they even, it doesn't matter if someone's going senile or not. The baddest drummer in the village, if he's 100 years old and he can't play anymore and can't talk, you don't say you're badder than him. That's
right.
A curse to say that.
Yeah.
He's still around. He's still there. You go still pay your respects to him every Saturday, whatever, mm-hmm. and you go back. You could be the baby. You don't even say when right. he guys, so-and-so is going to be there, or I'm next in line. You don't even utter those words. He's alive. He's there.
Yeah.
He created a certain scene for us to learn this music. He's still a master, and we have to respect that. There's nothing to really even talk about there. So it was interesting that you talk about like the whole thing with the order of it, and it makes those societies and those little villages that I went to so much. It made so much sense. It was simple things that I was like, wow.
You mentioned talking about your elders, and it's funny we could be talking all day, but you guys got a gig, and I know just a couple last questions. I want to talk about how you played with the Stones on this tour. You mentioned it earlier. How was it playing with the Rolling Stones on one of your first tours? One of the most revered bands of all time.
It was crazy. It was a lot of fun. They one of the things that was funny, man, is that they really opened the door for us to be with them. Because it was kind of, it's intimidating. You know what I mean? They're the freaking Stones. And we were kind of like in our dressing room, just kind of go do the gig. And it was like, hey, man, how come guys are not hanging out? They were like thinking that we were kind of like sort of being, I don't know what. But it was just because they've been the Stones for so long that it's just the way they live. And then we were like, come on, hang out. So we were in their dressing room more than we were in our own dressing room.
Which is pretty rare because, being a headlining band, how often do you hang out with the opening band, right?
Well, the Stones is, the thing about that is the door swings open. If the door swings open to you, you really are in.
Oh, gotcha.
But if the door swings closed,
it's a wrap.
The phrase persona non grata is no
You're
joke.
Out.
There was a person who had been selling had been selling passes, and he was found out, and he had been with the organization for quite a long time, and he was out. He was literally done. He vanished. His name never came up. It was over. And that's kind of the way they handled things. If you were in, and it wasn't like, oh, there are rules. You didn't have to be careful. You could talk. You could talk to, hey man, play ping pong with Bill Wyman, whatever. But there were certain things you didn't trade on the fact that you didn't use the fact that you were in the Rolling Stones circle as trade.
Mm.
If you did that, you were out.
Mm.
We didn't think of it, but we saw what happened.
mean, someone trying to hustle him or something from the inside, or?
Well, Doug knows about being with the camp. I mean, the camp is really, like, for us, you know, Doug knows the camp. He was in it. But for us, it was a new experience, and everyone was gracious. Jagger had us come. Keith was always cool. You know, he's worked with them individually on their records as well. But, I mean, for us as a band coming on, being allowed to sound check, wow, having Mick ask you questions on the sound check, come into our dressing room and say, this is too small. I'm going to give you guys a bigger room. Make sure every day somebody comes over to our dressing room and hang. It's not... You know, it's not our tour. I invited you guys on this tour. You know, it's a little. I had a little beef with a guy I used to call Scarface. We had a play beef, but you know, it was edgy play beef. And it was Keith's security guard. He had this knife wound on his face. And I used to call him Scarface. Yeah.
Big game.
Yeah. He's a, and you know, he always messed with me. He always said, "Yo, man, you know, the wind would blow my pants." Would turn around, and he would always go, "Hey, you're not allowed. You're not in the band." And I was like, "Come on, man!" You know, and he was a big dude who felt like the side of a building. You know, you shook this guy's hand; it was like brick. and he would say, "No, mate, you're not allowed." And he would say, "Turn your pass around." So we had this kind of joke. And I used to always say, "When you get to New York, we play Shea Stadium. I got a couple of homies. You're gonna disappear. You don't have no idea." You know, we had this little thing going on, but Mick didn't know that. So one day I was walking on stage on the thing, and my pass was turned around, and he stopped me. And he was doing this thing sometimes where he would block me, like, "You know, man, you can't get up here. You can't get up here." So you know, I turned the pass around. He's like, "Yeah, you better keep that pass." And Mick was far away, and he walked up to me. We were sound checking, and he was like, "Is there a problem on the tour?" I'm like, "Nah, man, everything is cool." He's like, "No, I need to know if there's a problem." I'm like, "Nah, everything's cool." And he thought I was afraid to not say anything, so he called him over, and he said, "I invited this band on this tour. If there's anything that needs to go down on this tour, that you know, you just let me know." Yeah. You know, and he was cool, and I was cool because we both knew we were joking. But
yeah,
Mick's vibe was like, "Even if you're joking, we're gonna put this is not cool.
Right?
Don't play those kind of games. You know, on a tour."
The Stones. I mean, again, you know, it's like you get these organizations, and they survive over many, many years. You know, through death, through you know, producers, and this and that. But it's the Rolling Stones. Now, if you look at how they run their organization, for example, Ronnie Wood, as long as he was in the Rolling Stones up until, he just got cut an equal partner a few
years
ago.
Just recently, yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? So they run, I mean, you know, you might think in your brain that you're entitled to have certain things, but that's not the case.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's Mick, Keith, now Ronnie, and Charlie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And one thing that the English are geniuses at is controlling their shit. One thing the English are great at is giving you advice. Yeah, that comes free. But what they do is they know how to control the environment. And I got a lot of I learned a lot work with Mick. You know, how to deal with people. You know, how to be social in certain environments. How not to brown nose. How to be around. You know, be your own person. It's like I got the gig with Mick Jagger because I come from the hip hop vibe. You know what I mean? And when I was, you know, I went through the auditions and stuff and everything, but I noticed how when a lot of people were there in the auditions and stuff, they were just brown nosed and they were all getting all excited. I didn't give a shit. Mm-hmm. I was just like, you know, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, the way I got tight with Mick was one day his brother Chris came in with a bag of weed and it was an ounce of fucking cess, and he walked right by me and I was like, I can smell the shit. You know what I mean? End of rehearsal. So everybody's over there. Mick is talking to everybody. A lot of folks are chatting to him. He gravitates towards me. He's like, "How you doing, Doug? Is everything all right?" I said, "Yeah, well, shit will be nice and fine if you roll one of those joints you got in that pocket." So I just kind of kept it real with him, you know what I mean? Yeah. I don't want to blow Mick up and everything.
You got to remember
like
he's
that.
The Rolling Stones. They've done everything.
But, yeah. I mean, that's a mere flex. But, yeah. But the point is, a person will respect
sure.
you more. For your honesty,
like,
yeah. and also knowing that they can put you in the environment and you're not going to embarrass them, or you're not going to take it upon yourself to think that you're writing the check, because
mm-hmm.
that's not the case. But so there's a lot to learn, and I know Mick well. Mick really took a lot of pride to look after Living Color.
Mm-hmm.
It meant a lot to him.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Because a lot of it it was personal. A lot of it could be, you know, hey, again, we can go back to, there's a guilt factor as well. You
right,
know,
the guilt,
a lot of money, you know what I mean? But they saw a lot in Vernon, you know?
Vernon, and they, it used to be a trip because every time when Living Color would come, and he could never remember anybody else's name. Dougie, what's the drummer's name? It's Will, okay? You know, whatever. So there was things that took place, but they went above and beyond while Mick and Keith are arguing, while they got their own tiff going on, while all that's, they had enough common sense to conduct business. The brand was bigger than the riff.
Right.
So when you're in that environment, listen, if you're the kind of person, if you're not that educated, but you're around very educated people for a certain period of time, it's going to rub off on you. Mm-hmm. If you're around idiots for a period of time,
it's going to rub off on you. We talked about
so
earlier,
the one thing about the English are really, really good at, first of all, there's the English, it's an island. Mm-hmm. So there's island mentality that goes with. There's things that excite them that don't necessarily excite us. In a sense like that. Like, they like certain things. I thought it was quite corny. You know what I mean? Certain things. Or like a band like a Liverpool football team could have a number one record in England.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm sitting there scratching my head. But the English have a way of, like, being... There's a social environment that takes place in England that just doesn't take place a lot of other places. Mm-hmm. Why? For us here, we have a lot of things to distract us. We have a lot of TV and stuff like that. When I went to England, there was 3 TV channels. Mm-hmm. The TV went off. At
midnight.
At midnight. So what did everybody do? Where was the most central point of activity? The pub.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where are you going to find a police officer in a little village? The pub. But what it did, pub mentality gave you a way of bringing everybody together. Just like what Will was saying, you know, you get an environment where people can come together and chat. Nobody can chat more than the English. You can meet an English person within 5 minutes. It's like, do I owe you money? And so they just take over. They have a gift of gab. Yeah. You know what I mean? They were able to rule the world by the gift of gab. You know what I mean? But when you're there after a while, you can recognize the tones. I'm like, I ain't going for that. I've heard, not me.
Were you ever up for that gig when Wyman left the band?
Yes.
Wow. Well, down to the final wire? Or?
No, it was very simple. You know, when I auditioned for, I did, Jeff Beck recommended me for the first Living Color audition. I got the audition. I got it from
Mick Jagger.
Jeff Beck.
For Mick Jagger's first solo record, I got recommended by a person named Keith Diamond. And also Jeff Beck, because I was coming off of working with Jeff Beck. Really, the idea was to have Jeff Beck's band
Mixed band. Right.
That's how, you know, so that's kind of, but it started with a whole other, like, other different guitar players and drummers and stuff. But that was really kind of like what was really going on. I had to audition 40 different bass players between New York, LA, and London. I got the gig. You know what I mean? Fast forward that got me into the camp. Then next thing you know, I meet Ronnie Wood. I end up doing Ronnie Wood's solo record. I was at Mick's Chateau in France, in Amboise. I'm in Tours, France, and Charlie Watts hadn't been playing drums for a few years. He's in the Arabian Horses and shit. He comes over to Mick's house, and he's like, Mick comes to me. He's like, Dougie, I need you to do me a favor. What? Can you work out with Charlie? Because he hasn't been playing in a while. Can you just, you know, work out with him? By the way, out of all the people that Mick chose out of the first cut of the musicians, I'm the only one that everybody else got replaced. I'm the only one that, that managed to sustain, to keep the gig. So I lived in England. I knew the English vibe. I knew the mannerisms. I knew how to be chill. I knew how to listen. And, you know, and I had a little bit of an edge just from that. But one thing led to another thing, led to another thing, led to another thing. I'm in the room at Olympic Studios when Will Calhoun called me. I'm actually watching 25 Times 5, which was a documentary that came out on the BBC about 25 years of the Rolling Stones. I got Keith Richards next to me right there, and I got Mick Jagger right there. We're in the studio. We've been cutting some tracks. And they're watching themselves on the BBC going back to when they were young, when they were first starting, and Mick is, and there's scenes of them like when they first got busted, and Mick was like, man, that was, and Keith is like, you were a f***ing cunt when that happened, weren't you? I knew you'd fucking, you know, they were, I'm watching, I'm like, this is great. Anyway, fast forward, you know, Will Calhoun calls me up to audition to do the Living Color gig. I got Charlie Watts and them saying, man, Dougie, this would be great for you, you know what I mean? But I still had to audition. Came, flew in, did the audition out of fairness. They auditioned a few other folks and they were like, listen, we got a gig in Brazil that's on the books. We want to make a change. We want, out of fairness to everybody, let's audition everybody. No problem. So I should have knew something was going on, because when I flew back into New York from London, I flew into a hurricane. It was a hurricane that was
omens and signs.
Omens and signs. But anyway, I went there, did it. They called me back. We want you to do the gig in Brazil. Did that, boom, got the gig, did the record, everything. Okay, fast forward. Now, Bill Wyman leaves the group. So, you know, Mick calls. I'm like the lucky, you know, they're auditioning again. They're auditioning again. So I'm like, okay. But I'm in Living Color at the time. I just joined Living Color. Right?
Yeah.
I just joined Living Color. I'm a couple, you know, about a year or so in on that cycle, if that. And then Mick calls me up. He's like, Dougie, can you come to Ireland? We want to meet over at Ronnie Wood's house. I already did Ronnie Wood's album over there. I had a bass amp over there still and shit. I didn't even have to bring my bass because I used Woody's Fender. And so I go over there. Cool. It wasn't an audition. We just went right in and started recording. Must have cut 20 tracks. Was no audition with the Stones.
What record was it?
The meeting for me to get together to be with the Stones. But I'm like, Mick knew I was already with Living Color. You know what I mean? So then he's like, I get back home, and then I'm like, I get a call, and then it's like, okay, Dougie, it's Mick. He said, listen, I want you to come in. I want you to do the record with us. I said, well, when is the record? When do you want me to cut the record? He said, it was in October of what, 93 or something like that. And they'd already auditioned all the other bass players, Daryl Jones already. He'd already did it. I said, okay, Well, Living Color, we have a tour in Australia at that time. So he said, well, how much is Living Color getting for the tour? He was going to buy the tour to buy him out. He's going to give a check to Bernard Fowler to deliver it to you guys. You know that, right? I don't even know. Ask Bernard. But then I said, you know, there were some difficulties going on. I said, well, listen, do me a favor. Call Vernon up. That's right. He called you up, right? Do you remember talking to Mick?
I remember him trying.
I know. Some darker days at that particular time. Yeah, but anyway, to sum it all up, I'm a very loyal person.
You made your commitment.
I made my commitment. Here's the bottom line. The bottom line is you're an employee with the Rolling Stones. Okay? Yeah. I came in and I was given a quarter of the deed to the land with Living Color.
And songwriting and everything else. With it.
So my vibe was I'm a very loyal person. I don't believe in like just jumping and doing that like that. You know, there's a certain amount of loyalty. Other cats would have did it like that. Mm-hmm. That's not in my DNA.
But so, obviously, you made the right choice. You're still here.
I believe in the band. Yeah. You know what I mean? And
I don't know why I'm still here. I do.
Last question. When I saw you guys last was on the stadium when you guys were playing at WrestleMania for CM Punk, yeah. Cult of Personality. That was it must have been a huge, maybe not a boost for you guys, but a huge way to get your music out to a completely different audience. How did that come to be where Punk was using your song?
The thing that's so funny about that, talking to CM Punk, and he told me a story. He said, you know what? When I was in Little League, Cult of Personality, he was 12 years old.
Yeah.
And Cult of Personality was their get out on the field music.
Mm.
And so he had just a complete connection to the song and to the band from when he was 12. And that's how that came up.
Mm.
He was like, yeah.
Could you imagine little Phil running out on the field?
Little Phil. But it's also very little rare Philip. For Vince McMahon to allow an actual recorded song from another band to be used.
It was one of the first times.
There's been a few here and
Static
there.
Static X, they used one. The
Undertaker used the Kid Rock song.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
It's pretty rare to have it for such a long period of time as he did.
Yeah, man. He's a real fan. He's a really special dude. And
that's cool.
We're happy, you know, we really wish him well.
Yeah, man.
You know,
his endeavors. Maybe he'll use Cult of Personality in the UFC.
Maybe.
Right? Maybe. But he's a good dude, and that was really a lot of fun.
Will, what's your favorite Living Color song to play?
To play live?
Yeah.
Time's Up.
Time's Up?
Yeah.
Nice. It's a thrasher.
Yeah, I like that. It's got nice changes. It's drum-oriented.
Yeah, for sure. How about you, Run?
Once again, the giant snare drum. On the road. New traffic circle coming soon.
How about you, Vernon? Your favorite?
Me? My favorite Living Color song to play. I actually have to say Cult of Personality. And that's partly because the writing of Cult of Personality, you know, is how it happened. It's like, it's not connected to the song being a hit. But it's connected to the fact that we used to have this loft in Williamsburg. And we had a rehearsal, And at the beginning of the rehearsal, there was no Cult of Personality. At the end of the rehearsal, the song was written, and we played it at the very next CBGB's gig, and the response to it was immediate. And that, to me, is like exemplifies us being out of the way, because it's easy to be in the way of the music. And it was like we were there, but the song wrote itself using us
right.
as components
as the conduits, yeah.
of its own creation.
Right.
We kind of didn't stop it from happening, and which is one of these amazing
just
moments.
A perfect example of kismet falling together.
It's an amazing moment. Like nothing interrupted it, nothing took it sideways. None of us tried to seize what it was. It all happened. I had the lyrics in my old red notebook, and it just kind of. And I wrote the thing as a poem.
Mm-hmm.
Look in my eyes, what do you see? The Cult of Personality. I had no music for it. I just wrote it. We came up with this thing, this riff. I said, "Well, play a beat to this." You know, Corey was singing something to me. I stumbled on the. Da, 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 da. I said, "Dude,
it's very much a product of our personality. Literally, our personalities, like how we all came about getting to it, like." What Will puts to the song is Will's personality in terms of how the beat is directed. How the guitar is done is strictly, you know, a Vernon Reid, whatever the fuck that is.
Riff, whatever weirdness, yeah.
You know, the melody, as it is very much what I do. And the bass playing was obviously when Muzz was in the band, was Muzzy. And we didn't stop doing that. We just kept going at it and
it just kind of came in layers.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of, we had that one riff, it has to go somewhere. So then we kind of went there and I was thinking, and really, like, even the chords, really, I was imitating my friend Raymond Jones. He was a keyboard player, he played with Chic. He's no longer with us, rest in peace. But he had a way of playing the piano with voice leading. Mm-hmm. I was really imitating on guitar,
his vibe, yeah.
The way this friend of mine used to, you know, he would just, he's kind of like influenced by Todd Rundgren.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of like the songs from the Hermit of Mink Hollow and things. There's, you know, Raimi said, man, listen to Todd Rundgren, how he moves his chords, his triads around. And so I was kind of like, oh, this is sounds like something, you know, so all of those sorts of things kind of came together and it just kind of.
That's the way it is, yeah. How about you, Doug? What's your favorite one to play live?
I think for me, it's very interesting. I got to tell you a little back. So you know how they say things happen in threes? Well, I got a call from Will, Bruce Springsteen, and Seal all in the same week to do something with them. And I always go with whoever the first thing was. So I said, okay, I'm going to go with Living Color because they're my mates, right? Yeah. So I had a little bit of time to figure out the stuff, the songs for just a couple of days, really. You know, I had to come in to do this audition. I said, okay, shit. So I knew Cult was okay. I figured that would be all right. So what I usually do in a situation like that, I pick the hardest song to learn first. And that song was Time's Up. Mm-hmm. So when I came to rehearsal, the guys asked me, okay, what do you want to do? What's the first song you want to do? I said, let's do Time's Up. And I can look at everybody's face, and they'll kind of stopped and paused.
You know why? You know why I got to interrupt? That's the one song none of the bass players wanted to play.
Wow.
Everybody who came to the audition said, I'll do any song, but not Time's Up.
Not that.
So when you said that, that's what made us kind of go, damn.
Right.
I had to say that. Because
right.
You know what's a funny story about that? When Metallica was going for a new bass player, it's Robert Trujillo, great player.
Yeah.
He did the same thing with the song Battery. Right. None of the other guys could play it properly. And his first one was like, what do you want to play? I'll play Battery. Are you sure? Yeah.
That's what you do.
And now you nail it with that's the top one, do, right? Man. Yeah.
That's it.
That's it, man. How about you, Corey? Last one? Favorite song?
Your ears went back in the
tune. They did.
Especially as a singer, too, because you're having a good night or a so-so night.
Yeah, it depends on how I'm feeling that night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's times when we do Desperate People that is
great
just,
tune.
Like,
maybe my favorite Living Color tune.
It's fun to play. But there's a part in Desperate People as a singer is at the top of my range mm-hmm. before I go to falsetto. That's difficult to do, and I'm thinking about that all the time when trying to get to that part.
You know it's coming.
I know it's coming.
Yeah.
So it's like I get up for it just for that particular song, and then the other nights it's like,
it. Let's just go.
And you want to do stuff like Go Away, and you want to do stuff like Postman.
Great
you
tune, Go Away.
You want to do stuff like Time's Up, because it's just like, I'm at heart like a little skater punk kid, you know, that listens to that kind of shit, you know. And that's that. Those kind of songs kind of fit into that kind of thing.
Right, right, right. Guys, it's been great talking to you, man. We could talk for another 2 hours if we wanted to, man. Thank you, guys.
Chris, thank you, guys. So
appreciate it. Thank you so much,
yeah,
man.
All right, Living Color are headed to Australia for the first time since 2014. The tour starts May 12th in Melbourne. If you live down under, if you live in a land down under, go see the show. You can buy tickets at livingcolor.com and pick up a copy of their new mixtape EP, Who Shot Ya, featuring three new songs from the Shade recording sessions. Thanks to all four members of Living Color. They're a very intelligent and a great, great rock and roll band. And what a cool thing. All four members of a band on Talk Is Jericho. That's a first. I loved it. Thank you so much to Living Color. If you're digging their music, or all the musical guests on Talk Is Jericho, like Living Color, Devin Townsend, Cheap Trick, Kenny G, Lars Ulrich, Tony Iommi, then sign up for the automated email alert so that you never miss a single guest, okay? Podcast1.com/Jericho. Be a part of the Talk Is Jericho army. Sign up at podcast1.com/Jericho, and you'll get all the information right to your email. Big thanks to you for doing that, and thanks for supporting all the Talk Is Jericho sponsors. Couldn't do this without you or them, and that includes Amazon, the OG sponsor. Easiest way to help out this show. Use my Amazon links whenever you do any online shopping. You find all my Amazon links at podcast1.com. Click on the Killer Deals button at the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk Is Jericho button. Got the Amazon links for the USA, the UK, the Canada, eh? Every time you buy something on Amazon, use those Talk Is Jericho Amazon links, and Amazon kicks back a small percentage to this show to help us cover production costs. You buy anything you want, just help us out. Like I said, podcast1.com. Click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the pagey wagey, then hit the Talk Is Jericho button. All the other sponsors are on there as well. DDPYoga.com/Jericho. Get 25% off all DDPY merch, and when you buy a max pack or a combo pack, you get a second one for 50% off the price. It's already 25% off. All right, and don't forget, March 15th, 2017. It's the biggest podcast ever. When Mick Foley joins Talk Is Jericho, the countdown rolls on, 33 days and counting. And if it's more big podcasts you're looking for, the Jericho Network has you covered. We're about to launch another new show very soon, but until then, you got Keeping It 100 with Conan, Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus, Beyond the Darkness 5 days a week, Team Tiger Awesome with hilarious pop culture reviews and analysis every Sunday. Right now, they've got Movie Monsters versus Movie Children. Who do you think is going to win? I think it's like, you know, Kevin from Home Alone versus Freddy Krueger. Go check it out. They're hilarious. Go hit the subscribe button on iTunes for all the great Jericho Network podcasts on Podcast One, and leave them all a rating and a review. Thanks for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP news headlines coming up next. And on Friday, you've been asking for this one. Back by popular demand, it's Talkin' Shop 5, live in Mexico, presented by Talk Is Jericho, hosted by Carl Anderson, and of course Luke Gallows with the rotating fourth, Enzo Amore. That's right. All your faves are going to be there as well. Rip Tile, Gordy Canuck, The Fink, The Hell Yeah Man. Sam Adonis is going to be there from Mexico. Total debauchery with some great wrestling stories mixed in. Gallows did this entire show with a coffee cup balanced on his head, just to show you where we were at. And we're back again on Friday. Don't you dare miss it. Until then, in the meantime and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy. See you on Friday.
You can download new episodes of Talk Is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com.